The Education Committee will come to order. And we have one bill on the agenda, and that is the Senate File 1253, which is Senator Wieger's bill. And we'll have Senator Wieger, and I believe the commissioner is here. And then I think also the number of people from the Department of Education. Senator Wieger, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dahl. Senate File 1253 is the department's policy technical omnibus bill. Several of the provisions were in last year's policy bill. Didn't quite make it because of a couple of controversial provisions, but so you should be familiar with several concepts. And by and large, it's not a controversial bill, though there will be a couple of provisions that will be, and those will be pointed out. Big picture, that's where we're at. I do have an amendment that's being drafted right now, and I would like to offer the A2 amendment, I believe it is.
Okay, thank you, Senator Wieger. The A2 amendment we will adopt as soon as we get a quorum, and we'll hand that out right now. And maybe what we could do is ask Commissioner Segrin to maybe share a few comments, since this is the department's the governor's policy portion. So, welcome, Senator or Commissioner Segrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just a few comments. I think Senator Wieger actually commented well on the bill. It does contain many of the things that were discussed last session, so you'll be familiar with many of the pieces of the bill. The amendment we will go over with. Dr. Melcher and Lisa Barnage, there's some clarification on the early childhood program and the way it has been administered for the last 18 years, and we're just trying to get the ECFE administration tied to the way we actually do things. So that's the clarification. But overall, probably the biggest change would be the charter school language, and our agency has worked very diligently with a number of different stakeholders in the charter school community to kind of tighten up and reflect on how we want our sponsors or authorizers to work as they're authorizing different charter schools, and so you'll see a lot of language in there regarding that. So that's probably the biggest change, and we'll have Assistant Commissioner Morgan Brown go over that. So if you would like Dr. Melcher to go over some of the changes, why don't we go ahead and let him do that if you wish.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Dr. Melcher, do you want to go through the Senator Wieger, we can deal with the amendment we don't have a quorum, so we'll wait until we have one. So, all right. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I think to address the page and line amendments, it might be best to wait until we're at the appropriate section of the bill, but I could go through the amendment on page 1, line 15 through line 28, which deals with the calculation of the early childhood family education revenue for tribal contract schools. This language was put in law. This program has existed since 1991. And at the time that this was put in law, it was envisioned by the legislature that the department would calculate the early childhood family education revenue. There are four tribal contract schools that received this money based on a formula rate equal to 1.5 times the state average expenditure per participant under the ECFE program for school districts. However, back in the early 90s and continuing until this day, the department does not have data on the number of participants in early childhood family education programs. And so for the last 18 years, this has been administered as a grant going out to those four schools. It's a total of $68,000. It's been allocated by our Indian Education Division as a grant to those four schools. At this point, we felt it wouldn't be appropriate to first request all of the school districts in the state to begin collecting and reporting detailed data on ECFE in order to drive the $68,000 on a formula basis, and it would also throw off the allocations that these four schools have received pretty consistently over the last 18 years. And so when it came to our attention that there was an inconsistency between the statute and the way it's been administered all these years, we felt that the most straightforward thing to do would be to change this to a grant program so that the $68,000 can continue to flow out the way that it has in the past, and so that we wouldn't be mandating a new reporting requirement on the school districts in these difficult times.
Okay, thank you. Maybe Dr. Melcher, do you want to maybe just start with Article 1?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to highlight that one item because it was a full section. I think the rest of it's easier to deal with as we go through the bill. But if we could turn to Article 1 of the bill then, beginning with Section 1. And Article 1, Section 1 is a change in the responsibility for reporting to the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. And in legislation recently, the legislature has changed the allocation of funding for the endowment, so there's no longer a subtraction, and there's more of an emphasis on making sure that we're getting a good value for our investment in the Permanent School Fund. And what this change does, it was a recommendation from the Department of Finance. It would require the State Board of Investment rather than the Department of Finance or Minnesota Management and Budget to report to the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee on the measures that it has taken in order to get a good rate of return on the dollars in the Permanent School Fund.
There's a committee, I believe, Senator Wieger, is working on different areas. Could you just very, very briefly kind of explain that to the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, division members, as a result of the legislation last year with the increased interest on the Permanent School Fund, we added a number of new members, private sector, as well as additional legislators from policy and finance committees. The group had its first meeting in the fall of 2008 and agreed to form four subcommittees to look at a number of aspects of the fund to see what could be done to enhance a number of challenges are put together in the work plan. Senator Dahl has joined that group. Senator Saxhog's part of it, for example, and work plans are now being developed to address those questions that have been raised by the overall group. So the group has expanded as a result of legislation, not only with legislators, but with private sector representation, and subcommittees have been formed to look further into the overall operation and an eye on getting more value or limited dollars.
Thank you. Dr. Melcher?
So, Mr. Chairman, this change is simply having the State Board of Investment report directly to the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. That way the information is coming directly from the experts at the State Board of Investment rather than secondhand through the Finance Department. This Section 2 of the bill would modify the exceptions to the Labor Day start in order to clarify that a school district that is involved in an academic pairing agreement with another school district that qualifies for a start of school before Labor Day due to a major construction project is also allowed to have a start before Labor Day. Typically, in these academic pairing agreements where One school district provides elementary education, the other one provides secondary education. Part of the agreement is that they have the same calendar. And so it only makes sense that if one school district has to delay or has to have a start earlier in order to accommodate the construction project, that the school district that it's paired with would also be able to do that. Section 3 of the bill is moving back the date for the report that the department produces, which is called the Consolidated Financial Report for School Districts, which provides public information on the financial status of school districts. We did some work last year with Senator Bonhoff to get that rolling. The current requirement is that the department produce that report by January 15th, and we're recommending that be moved back to February 15th to allow the department to have sufficient time to use the final UFARS data rather than doing one report kind of quick and dirty and then publishing another set of numbers. It's very confusing to the public if you have one set of numbers and then you revise it a month later with updated numbers. So we're just recommending that that date be moved back to February 15th.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Melcher, have you gotten any feedback from school districts or parents whether or not they have appreciated or noticed the new type of reporting and whether that's been helpful for people?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, I have received a number of phone calls, and I've used that on a number of occasions when I've had members of the public ask for the information, and it seems to be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, just to let people know how this came about, because it is interesting that citizens really can make a difference. There was a group of parents and who worked with educators in the business community to put forward a new way of reporting school finances that would be more understandable to the public. And then, you know, we brought it forward, heard it in policy, and ended up really having an additional way of reporting school finances. So I appreciate the help of the department for working on that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, moving on to Section 4 of the bill, this is a similar change that would move the date for the department to report on which school districts are in statutory operating debt back from January 1st to February 15th. Again, we've attempted to publish that data on January 1st, but when we do that, we have some school districts that have not yet completed their reporting to the department, and so we have an incomplete report, and then we need to go back and revise the report. So we feel it's better to move it back until we have accurate data. It's still quite early in the legislative session, and to then publish one report rather than doing a report in January and then another report in February. Section 5, 7 through 8, and 11 are all dealing with the compensatory revenue that's paid to cooperatives and how that then feeds its way through the tuition billing system for special education. Currently, we've had a very complex special education tuition billing system implemented, but there have been some issues that have arisen as it relates to compensatory revenue. Under current law, we pay the compensatory revenue to the resident school district, and then we direct them to allocate that to the cooperatives. We also have a system where we're calculating tuition billing for special education students, and we include the compensatory revenue in calculating the tuition bills. And so we've had a problem where we're telling the districts to transfer the compensatory revenue, but we're also transferring part of the compensatory revenue ourselves through the tuition billing system. And so then it becomes very difficult for the school districts to figure out, well, how much of the compensatory revenue did you already transfer on our behalf through tuition billing as opposed to us doing the transfer? And we think it would be a much simpler system if we simply paid the cooperatives directly the compensatory revenue that they have coming and then take it out of the tuition billing system. So we'd have a little bit simpler special education tuition billing system. We also would avoid the need for the school districts to be paid the money and then write a check to the cooperative to pay them the money. So we think it provides a little bit of simplification and transparency in terms of the tuition billing system and the payment of funds. Moving to Section 6 of the bill, that would be on page 5. This would require that in order to qualify for general education funding, that foreign exchange students must be enrolled in a cultural exchange program that's registered with the Office of the Secretary of State. We do have a requirement currently for foreign exchange programs to be registered with the Office of the Secretary of State. So this is aligning the general education funding system with the existing requirement for this reporting. It does provide an assurance that this is, in fact, a legitimate cultural exchange program that has been registered. It provides some safety information or some contact information for the school district in the event that there's some sort of issue that comes up. They know who to contact then, because that information would be included in the registration of this program with the Secretary of State's office. So we don't think this is a controversial thing, but just the issue has come up a couple of times in terms of finding out what the contact is for this organization. Moving to Section 9 of the bill, we have some technical changes in the calculation of the lease levy authority for school districts that are eligible for lease levy authority under a subdivision dealing with school districts that are involved with desegregation plans. This particular section of law has not been updated since the new graduation rule was established back around 2000, and this is updating the cross-references in here and the language here to correspond to the changes that have occurred since 2008 with regard to the desegregation rule and the changes in the formula for calculating integration aid. So this reflects current department practice. There's no change here other than to simply update the references in law to correspond to the changes that have occurred in the DSEG rule and the clauses, the cross references, and so forth in the integration revenue formula. Section 10 is a more substantive policy issue that relates to the maintenance of effort requirement for staff that are involved in licensed support functions, such as school counselors, other licensed school support, including school nurses, social workers, psychologists, chemical dependency counselors, and so forth. Under an amendment that was adopted this past year, there is a requirement first that school districts use $3 per pupil out of their Safe Schools levy for this particular staffing category. But the section that the department is proposing to repeal is on page 8, lines 12 through 15 of the bill, which currently requires a school district to annually certify that its total spending on the services provided by these employees is not less than what it spent the year before. So, in effect, what we have currently in law is a requirement or a mandate that school districts must not reduce the total dollars that are spent on these support service employees, the licensed support service employees, including guidance counselors and that group of staff, from year to year to year. And I think there was a very positive thing to try to promote those particular areas, but we think it creates some significant budget problems for school districts in a time frame when they may be faced with budget cuts. So under current law, if a school district has declining enrollment, let's say, and they need to do some reductions in staffing, this would prevent them from reducing the number of staff that they have in these particular areas, which would force bigger cuts in their teaching staff, as an example. Also, if a school district has an experienced guidance counselor retire who's at the top of the salary schedule and they need to hire a new one at the bottom of the salary schedule, they can't do that under current law because they have to spend exactly the same number of dollars as they did the year before. So what the department is recommending is that this maintenance of effort requirement be eliminated so that each local school board, if it's facing budget reductions, that they have the flexibility to decide how to do that and looking at all of the categories of staff and not taking this particular group of staff off the table in terms of any sort of budget reductions that they're doing.
Let the record reflect that there is a quorum, and Senator Wieger moves the The A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention that I appreciate that provision because that during these times, particularly where we're looking at potentially cutting budgets, anything we can do to lift spending mandates is appreciated.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe that is the end of the items that I'm covering in Article 1, and we're moving next to Article 2.
Okay. Any questions that members have on the provisions? One question, Dr. Melcher, maybe you'd probably be back, but in that moving of the date on those reports, how does that fit with the February forecast? Will there be a problem with that information and the February forecast?
Mr. Chairman and members, no, that will not create a problem for the February forecast. We are not changing the dates that we require the school districts to report their UFARS data to the department. There's another statute that requires school districts to annually report or finalize their annual financial reports by December 31st. It's just that if the financial reports are due December 31st, it's very difficult for the department to turn around a report on January 1st identifying who's in statutory operating debt. And we do have the inevitable thing where we have a half a dozen districts that are a little late in their reporting. And so what this does is allows the department to do the report once rather than twice and actually frees up a little time for us to get the February forecast done on time because we're not publishing some of our financial reports first with preliminary data and then again with final data.
Okay. Thank you. Great. Senator Wieger?
Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, members, Dirk Mattson with the Department of Education, one of a number of folks that will be coming up regarding Article 2. Just the first element on Section 1 is simply some language on page 11 for both science and language arts assessments that identifies when those assessments excuse me, will be aligned to the new set of standards. This does nothing more than provide a clarification and make transparent the date by which the standards and the assessments will align. It currently requires students to be responsible for those standards in those years, and we're just articulating that the assessments will be aligned in that same year.
Dr. Ani will take the next section.
Dr. Ani.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to go over the course credit section. The proposed language clarifies the definition of course credit so that it's linked to state academic standards or local academic standards where state standards do not apply. Currently, we have two different systems in this regard. Minnesota has state standards in language arts, mathematics, arts, science, and social studies, and we require local standards in the arts, health and phy-ed, and career and technical education and world languages. The arts at the local level is if they're not using the state standards. On the other hand, we have a system of credits in addition to this system of standards. Currently, the state requires 21.5 credits for graduation. 7 of those credits are elective. Those graduation requirements went into effect with the graduating class of 2007-2008, so last year's graduation class. However, in our state, these two systems of standards and credits exist as parallel systems. Currently, schools can award credit for courses that actually lack state or local academic standards. As a result of this policy, some students are taking courses that lack academic rigor. And by closing this credit loophole, so to speak, the state sends a strong message about the importance of all standards, not just in those subjects that have state tests. The expected outcome of this policy change would be that students would be exposed to more rigorous curriculum at the high school level, and of course there'd be greater equity across the many kinds of curricula offered by our school districts.
Dr. Ani, who would this actually have a real impact on? Any idea?
Mr. Chair, I have a good sense of where the impact would be greatest, at least in terms of subject areas. Currently, we have a number of schools that are not offering the full range of social studies standards to students. If they haven't revisited the so-called traditional curriculum that they've offered across the years, if they haven't updated their curriculum to reflect the standards, then students are missing out on key standards, especially in the areas of economics and geography. Those seem to be two areas that are especially problematic for schools if they haven't rethought their curriculum under the new standards. Another area would be the arts. Sometimes schools are offering what are actually excellent career and technical education courses designed to address certain art standards. And for one reason or another, they can't go through with the implementation, sometimes because the teacher's not highly qualified to be delivering, in one case, the visual arts standards. So, you know, the latest example that I heard was a school offering home interior design. The teacher has actually had a little bit of background in arts education, and the course was deemed to be very well aligned with the visual arts standards. But because that teacher was not highly qualified in visual arts, she couldn't deliver that course. So sometimes then the decision becomes for the school, well, let's choose an arts area then, or find an arts area where we could fit this. And it often is a mismatch. In Minnesota, visual arts and music have to fit under that highly qualified designation, whereas the other arts areas do not. So you sometimes get a mismatch, or in some cases the district says, we're not addressing the standards. We can't. So in more cases than not, we see where there are problems with scheduling or licensure issues or a crowded curriculum. There are a number of reasons why districts offer credit without linking it to state standards or local standards.
Can you kind of zero in another level and actually look at what districts or groups of districts that might be affected?
It's difficult to say, Mr. Chair. Sometimes we get questions from schools that are very small in nature and lack resources to provide all the standards, or they don't have teachers maybe who have background in all the areas of the standards. It's a variety of reasons. I hesitate to say this would most impact rural schools or schools of a small size, because these examples have come from schools of various sizes and geographic locations.
Wouldn't it make more sense to try to provide the resources before we put the mandates in place?
Resources, Mr. Chair, are always a question from schools. And while that makes a lot of sense, you also have to look at the fact that some schools have just not reorganized their curricula. We know this to be the case with some schools. They are offering the same curriculum that they did years ago. And if that's the case, resources are not. They're not going to be meeting the state standards.
Senator Bonhoff and then Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I actually have so many questions about this particular provision. It seems a pretty sweeping change without having spent much time looking at least among the committee members, looking at the facts. So, for example, with regard to the arts, do all schools have specified local standards in their music, theater, visual arts programs? And what type of oversight do you think that the department can provide to look at every single school district, local standards versus, you know, credit application? That's my first question.
Ms. Ani or Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as to your first question, schools don't offer state standards or local standards in all arts areas, but they are required to offer them in the number of arts areas designated for that level. So that varies from elementary to middle school to high school. So as to whether or not they currently are complying with state law, we would need a survey to determine that with any certainty. And your second question was about...
Mr. Chair, but Dr. Ani, how would you... I mean, do you have the staff to be able... It seems like this is a lot of work to go through the curriculum and the standards and look at how they're assigning credits for every school district in the state.
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the department currently does not provide curriculum oversight in terms of implementation of standards. So that is left to the local level. The department does not have authority to be judging whether or not the school districts are meeting the standards. So there are other kinds of accountability devices, I guess, that are considered.
Mr. Chair, So how would you enforce this new change in statute?
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, to my knowledge, the department doesn't have enforcement ability with this wording.
Mr. Chair, and then I had an additional question with just the example you gave. How would putting this standard in fix the less than qualified teacher problem?
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it doesn't address that problem.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Ani, I just want to be sure I understand how this, in this construction, does the new language modify both the academic year of study or a student mastering the applicable subject matter? See, there's two things that are... what constitute a course credit. So if it's either the year of study or the of a particular subject or the student mastering that, it is required to have the state standards or local academic standards where state standards do not apply. Is my reading of that correct, or which does it do?
Dr. Ani?
Is it just applying to the second part or both parts?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the intention was that it would apply to both parts.
Okay. And then I have another question. Does this mean, Mr. Chair and Dr. Ani, does this mean that any subject, say in the electives that aren't identified here that may be provided, if they don't have a standard, then they can't be given a credit for it?
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that issue has come up, and you know, there's two schools of thought on that. One would say no, it doesn't apply, so the language would need to be adjusted. The other school of thought is that most elective courses, you know, take for example anatomy. If the standards are mastered previously in courses leading up to anatomy, which is usually the case with a course like that, the course would still be applying the standards in other kinds of situations that weren't necessarily covered in the prior biology course. So there's still the applicable subject matter in this case is still the standards. So there are two ways we could go with that.
So, Mr. Chairman, for example, even health and phi ed or some of the vocational, any career and tech areas, if they don't have established some clear, we don't have state standards for those, and if they don't have a specific, they may have a curriculum, but not necessarily standards for these courses, could you not give credit for them by this new language?
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe you could and you would award credit for that because they're still required under state law to have locally developed standards. So depending on what their standards are at the local level, they would or they would not award credit.
So, Mr. Chair, then there is a requirement for local standards for these courses, for all courses. If there aren't state standards in place.
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's not a requirement that standards address all courses currently. The requirement is simply that they develop local standards for career and tech ed and health and phi ed.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was my question, is that schools are required to have local standards if for every course, if state standards are not in place.
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, they're required to have locally developed standards. The law doesn't actually include the wording that says for every course. So that's what this language would attempt to address.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman and Senator Dr. Ani, then that it is adding a mandate to have local standards for every course that's offered in order to have it be eligible for a credit.
Dr. Ani?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the attempt here is to make sure that the courses that provide that provide all the standards are in place so that all students have access to all standards. Whether the wording would need to be changed to accommodate certain electives that go beyond the standards is another matter. But right now, the language of the law simply tells school districts to develop local standards. It doesn't tie it to any coursework kind of language. So we're seeking to make that connection.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
Dr. Ani, I think you're hearing that we have some concern about this because it opens up this whole question about whether or not these kids can get credits for courses, and it seems like there should be a step in the middle compared to what's in here, and so perhaps to allow us to move forward with the rest of the bill, I might move to delete on page 12, line...
Section 2. Or, Mr. Chairman, will there be further time to address this in terms of what this bill is going to do?
I think obviously there's a lot of discussion about how we or what we do in terms of the standards, but I think the discussion is probably good. I think the issue that they're trying to address is how do you coordinate the standards and the courses that are being offered. So I'm not sure that actually solves the problem. I don't think it's clear yet to the committee members how we address that problem. I see problems with resources, for local districts. I see, but by eliminating it, then we're just left with the way the law is right now. So we're not, that doesn't clarify the issue, I don't think. So I think we need more discussion on this thing. I'm not sure we can solve it right now here today, but I think I'm unclear too as to exactly what local standards I mean, I think Senator Olson brings up a good point. There's this problem, but I'm not sure but that eliminating it actually moves us forward on this. Commissioner, you would like to say a few words?
Mr. Chair, I would just encourage the committee. I know that there's some concerns raised, and I think what we should do is probably try to clarify the intent. You know, we are concerned, and I think there's been a lot of signals, and certainly we wrote this before. The clear signals from the federal government have come down as far as states assuring that we have rigorous standards. Especially for college and career readiness, and that all the indicators that they're going to be looking at as far as all the stimulus money that we're receiving and the reporting is going to be surrounding a number of guidance areas, which is one of them is assuring that we are moving forward with rigorous standards. And so I think even before that, you know, discussion came down, we were also trying to make sure that we have make sure that, you know, even as we've developed state standards, that they are being applied and that they are being used within either course credits or in are within courses, and the standards can be spread, you know, among different courses. But to assure that, I think what we're getting tripped up on is maybe the potential of the local and whether they're all the local types of courses are covered and should have standards required. I would think at a minimum our local districts would have curriculum expectations and instruction that is around those local electives. But I think we were really trying to just clarify that if there are locally developed standards that apply to some of our credits that we do require by the state, that they assure that there are local standards that have been developed for those. So we may want to clarify that, and we would be glad. I think the discussion is really good. You know, we don't certainly want to increase mandates at a time when we can't afford to do that. But we also want to make sure that we are sending a signal that we need to be consistent in the application of the standards that we have developed.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, withdraw.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, if I could stir the pot just a little bit more here before we make a vote on Senator Bonas. Why are we... we're talking about a course credits relating to a student successfully completing an academic year of study. We're talking about standards. Why wouldn't we just say a course credit is equivalent to a student successfully mastering the applicable state or local standards for a respective subject matter as determined by the local school district?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that was... It has always been inferred by many curriculum directors and department staff that that exactly was the intent of this definition, that it should say exactly that. However, there are others when this was passed years ago that wanted that time definition put in there because many people were unclear as to what does it mean to have standards-based education. What we know is time. We understand Carnegie units. So let's, in this transition period, let's accommodate both.
You know, I think we do need some additional time to kind of work things out because I think what we want to do is we want to be sure the districts have the authority
and understand what's expected.
Right. And I mean, there's several factors here, I think, that come to play. One is, I think, to what the commissioner just mentioned about the academic standards, or, I mean, the standards and the rigor of the standards. Two is being sure that the districts have the authority to, in the right place, and that they can enact that, and then the third one is the resources. And I'm not, you know, I don't think any one of them are actually the way it should be yet. So Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that it's best to withdraw my motion to delete it, and that perhaps just, you know, commit that we'll work together to somehow clarify the language in a way we're all comfortable with.
I think that would be the best, because I think we understand what you're like to achieve, but somehow we need to do some more wordsmithing on this. So Senator Bonhoff removes her amendment. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Ani, are you finished then?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair, in Section 3, Dr. Wary will address AP training for teachers.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senators.
Good morning. If you would please give your name for the
record. I'm Sally Wary with the Department of Education, currently Supervisor of High School Initiatives. I'm addressing the addition of the proposal to provide more flexibility to advanced placement training. Subdivision 1, C, the Commissioner may award state-funded competitive grants designed to create advanced placement summer training institutes. This is the intent of this proposal is to enhance the flexibility of funding for summer programs. The legislature has a long history of providing support for advanced placement and and teacher training for advanced placement. The current allocation of $4.5 million is divided between advanced placement and international baccalaureate, with 75% of those dollars going to advanced placement programming and 25% to international baccalaureate. Of those monies, at least $500,000 is to be spent on teacher training.
Excuse me, Ms. Wary.
Page 13? I'm sorry.
Okay, page 13, and Senator Salzman, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, Senators.
Senator Salzman?
I'm sorry.
Did you just want the where we were, or no. Do you have a question?
A question, so okay. Maybe she'd like to continue, Mr. Chair, and then I could ask.
Okay, all right, Ms. Wary.
The current funding for the current biennium includes $4.5 million to be divided between advanced placement and international baccalaureate. Of that, at least $500,000 is to go to teacher training. In previous years, we have been able to cover that training in state for the most part, with a few teachers going out of state. Our problem has come at the end of a biennium when dollars do not carry over under the current system. So, for instance, in 08, we had 382 teachers trained in June at Augsburg and Carleton, another 196 in July, another 35 in August. We had a total of 613 teachers trained in-state in advanced placement, and another 34 went out of state. However, in fiscal year 09, we may not comfortably afford teachers the opportunity to be trained in July and August. We are proposing providing grants to higher education institutes through a competitive system that would allow us to offer those kinds of training opportunities. And a more increasing access and flexibility for both teachers and higher education institutions.
Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question I would have is that, and I think we've discussed this before, is college in the schools. And what I've heard from faculty, we heard from Dr. Schmidt when he was here with Tim's, is AP really addressing the needs of higher education, especially in math and science? So what kind of efforts are being done? Because I understand in talking with the University of Minnesota, I went over and spent some time when they were doing a training, is how they're developing courses, and I guess specifically in math and science, that, you know, in talking with the people in IT, they've questioned whether or not AP is really preparing them. So in this, would you see any opportunity to expand that? Because, again, this is where we're training teachers here in state, and the idea between college and the schools, then you have faculty within our higher ed here to support them throughout their course training. And I just wanted to know if there's some openness to looking at that as opposed to just AP and IB, because there seems to be. The other issue I have is that when you get a course credit from the U of M, most colleges are more open to taking that. Private colleges don't have to take AP course credits, or they can accelerate you, but you don't actually get credit for it. So I just want to just see if you're open, if there might be some openness to looking at that and certainly working with our higher ed institutions.
Mr. Chair, Senators, the department has always been open to a variety of options for dual credit. Advanced placement, international baccalaureate, concurrent enrollment, including college and the schools, post-secondary enrollment option, CLEP. We are encouraged by all of the opportunities for dual credit. This is not an either, we don't see this as an either or. But one thing we do, the advanced placement courses, you are correct, not all institutions accept advanced placement proficiency scores equally. And that's true nationally, not just in Minnesota. However, having said that, the statistics on students who have enrolled in completed advanced placement scores in terms of their participation in higher education and their graduation within 4 to 6 years is extremely strong. So it's not to denigrate one system over another. They all have opportunities. And there are different resources and capacities among our districts in Minnesota where one system may work better than another.
Hey, Senator Saltzman.
There. So on that point, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I would totally agree with you that the need for flexibility is important, and that's why I think that I would like to perhaps pursue or encourage us to look at having a pool of dollars, because what I hear from some districts is we chase the dollars. That's where the dollars are. So that's why we choose this program over another, because the pool of dollars, that's where we can access dollars. That's my thought, is greater flexibility and being more responsive. So I just offer that. And I do agree with the AP. It's a good indicator, but so is college and the schools. So.
Okay, Senator Rummel and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarifying question. When you have in paragraph C, advanced placement, lowercase letters, are you offering courses in advanced placements and IB, or just advanced placement?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm sorry. This was intended to address just advanced placement, because that has been the most problematic in terms of in-state training. International Baccalaureate offers its training through its international organization, and it's not something that is as readily available in-state.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not clear to me just what this does. You enumerated the amount of money that's available in the set-aside that's for the teacher preparation. Is this asking for more money? Is it asking for breaking away the amount of the set-aside to use in grants for this purpose to institutes of higher education? Or I'm not sure how you're spending the money now. You described the different segments and how many teachers it trained, but what would this provision do differently than what you described?
Ms. Query?
Mr. Chair, Senators, what this does is offer flexibility. It doesn't change the amount of money that the appropriation has been set by the legislature, but we have been bound by the June 30th fiscal year, which at the end of the biennium has forced us or made it difficult to extend any trainings into July and August on the second year of the biennium. If we grant the money to higher education institutes from October to October, then the money has gone out the door, and it allows teachers and higher education institutions more flexibility.
Thank you.
So, if I heard you correctly, you're saying that according to your calculation, there would not be a cost to the carry forward.
It's just really a technical.
Mr. Chair, Senators, this is really just a technical change. It's not a policy change.
Okay.
It's a technical change in how the dollars are allocated. We have worked with, in the past, primarily Augsburg and Carleton in our summer institutes.
Yeah, but it's the educators' training is part.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I thought we heard testimony that the agency was seeking permission because of where the fiscal year falls, that there's some permission in this language to carry the money into essentially the second biennium. There's existing statutory authority that under Chapter 16A that gives the agency authority to do that within the confines of a particular biennium. I think the issue becomes what happens after that, and my reading of that law does that we might, I'm not sure that authority exists, and this is an expansion and probably should carry a cost.
Yes. Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Barnage, and I am also from the Department of Education. Although I don't have the Chapter 16 in front of me, I do know that by making this a grant, Chapter 16 does allow expenditures on grants to go 12 months past the time the money was appropriated to the department. And so it's by making the grants to the higher institutions that we're hoping to bypass this issue with the June 30th date.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, 16A.28, I think we're going to have to work this out with the Department of Finance. Agencies may carry forward unexpended and unencumbered non-grant operating balances from the first year of a biennium into the second. And then sub 2 says no money shall be carried forward without the approval of the Commissioner of Finance. So unless there's a different section of law that you're thinking of, I think we've got an issue here.
I'm not sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I noticed, though, that you're saying 16A?
Chapter 16 is the old Department of Administration statute that's been completely repealed.
Okay. So that's the only part of the – sorry, again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
It's been recodified.
Oh, okay.
I had checked with our grants division, and they currently do use – the statute that I'm referring to for other grants. So it was our impression that we could do this.
We'll consult with finance on that. Senator Roblin.
And I understand what they're doing, because as far as the state is concerned, the money would be expended whenever they gave the grant out. But then there's limitations on when the grants have to be used before they would have to kick back. So they would have some time to do it, to expend it as a receiving grant recipient. They have a little extra time, I believe, before it has to come back.
I think the issue here is a change from existing law to a grant would be considered an expansion. So, but we'll definitely work it out. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, Section 4 on World Language Proficiency Certificates will be addressed by John Mellick.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, can I – one more question on instead – this is – the $500,000 was for teachers to attend institutes. This is going to be grants to higher ed institutions. Do they have to allow teachers to attend free then if they provide them? Because the language in the session law is that the $500,000 is for teachers.
Ms. Wary?
Mr. Chair, senators, yes, it would need to be written in the grants that according to the appropriation that the legislature has put. It would have to be according to the language in the appropriation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wary. Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is John Mielek. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education, and I'm the Director of Educator Licensing. This morning I'd like to talk to you about Section 4, World Language Proficiency Certificates. We do have some amended language I'd like to go over first. Page 13, line 32, delete private, insert non-public. Page 14, lines 2 and 8, delete both oral and written, and insert listening, speaking, reading, and writing. Page 14, line 8, delete demonstrated, insert demonstrate.
I believe, Mr. Chair, these were included in the A2.
Correct. We adopted those changes. So,
the World Language Proficiency Certificates are a mechanism for recognizing value and celebrating all students who achieve oral and written communicative competence in more than one language. Created to encourage two population groups towards the goal, for English speakers to develop skills in world languages, and two, for English language learners not only to develop English skills, but also to maintain and develop proficiency in their native languages. The Minnesota World Language Proficiency Certificate, which would be the first of two certificates, would be for students who demonstrate listening, speaking, reading, and writing skills at the American Council on Teaching of Foreign Languages Intermediate Low Level on a valid and reliable assessment tool. For languages listed as Category 3 by the U.S. States Foreign Service Institute or Category 4 by the United States Defense Language Institute, the standard is intermediate low for listening and speaking and novice high for reading and writing. Those languages are languages such as Arabic, Cantonese, Japanese, Korean, and Mandarin. The standard is set a little bit lower on those languages because they are considered to be more difficult for English speakers. The second certificate is the Minnesota World Language Proficiency High Achievement Certificate. This recognizes students who demonstrate listening, speaking, reading, and writing language skills at the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Language pre-advanced level for K-12 learners on a valid and reliable assessment tool, and for languages listed as Category 3 by the United States Foreign Service Institute or Category 4 by the United States Defense Language Institute. The standard is pre-advanced for listening and speaking and intermediate mid for reading and writing.
Mr. Millick, if somebody was reading this new language and they read, you know, Category 3, Category 4, would they understand what that is?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we would hope that the world language community and the districts that would be looking at this language would understand what we mean. Those are common terms used in those both of those groups.
Senator Polk.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, as a graduate of the Defense Language Institute, it is CAT 4, CAT 3, those are standard. They're quite well known, so, but thanks.
Well known by some, I suppose. Senator Salson.
At this point, Mr. Chair, I just went through my daughter going through the U of M and trying to get, you know, sort of in her correct foreign language course, and she had taken AP, had passed AP. First of all, just a few questions. Is there a cost to this, and who would pay the cost? And secondly, I guess this kind of goes back to the AP test, is that I learned that most of the larger universities in our country, U of M, University of Ohio, I mean, all the Big Ten schools, do not accept AP credit, that students have to go through essentially an 8-hour placement, a series of courses. Had I known that before my daughter took the AP course, why are we paying using state dollars for students to take AP language courses when they probably already know where they're going to school and already would know that their college is not going to accept AP? It's pretty much worthless. So how does this all fit together, and what would be the intent? Because when I look at how, what I'm hearing across the board is that higher ed only in languages does their own placement test. How does that fit with this? And I'm looking at it as, are we spending money on something? And I should have brought this up during AP, is why are we, you know, putting state dollars in when it's not of use to students?
Mr. McMillick?
Mr. Chair, Senators. This does not have a cost to it. This is a, one, you're very correct about the world languages. Typically, students will take their 2 years, meet their requirement, and that does not always give them the skills to step right into a college-level world language course. What we would like this certificate to do is to encourage study beyond the 2 years and to recognize those students who do. The benchmarks that have been set for each of these certificates are the benchmarks that would be more commonly used as the entrance requirements to a college world language level of study. By encouraging these students to continue their studies, the hope is that they'll be more world language ready when they do get to the college university level. We did develop this language in consultation with the Center for Advanced Research on Language Acquisition at the University of Minnesota, as well as the World Language Quality Teaching Network and World Language and English Language Learner Supervisors from both Minneapolis and St. Paul. We were hearing some of the same concerns. We thought that maybe a certificate that recognized someone who invested more time than just the 2 years would encourage that deeper level of study.
Senator Cole.
So, Mr. Chair, so they would basically take a test to demonstrate proficiency. We really have nothing to do with the classes that they necessarily the classes that they took. It would be their own proficiency that would be tested. And what the assessment tool that you're using is it's are you don't specify a specific assessment tool, is that correct?
Mr. Millett.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that's correct. The we've not specified an assessment tool. We've assessed it or provided the benchmark. There are a number of different assessment tools that districts use for students, and so we've provided what the benchmark would be that they need to score and equivalency what those would need to be using the American Council of Teaching of Foreign Languages. Given the variety of assessments used at the local level, we didn't want to mandate what assessments they needed to use. We wanted to recognize the tools and the abilities that the students have, as well as the assessment materials already available at the local level.
Okay, thank you. Please go on.
At this time, that is all I have for the certificates. Okay.
Dr. Mattson will address the next two sections on assessments.
Thank you, Senator Weger. Mr. Chair, members, Section 5 deals with, just at the beginning of it, just some quick technical adjustments in the early lines of 1420 and 1422. There is a portion starting on 1424 that addresses field testing and the request, the recommendation to require districts or schools when selected to participate in that. It certainly is, although it may seem counterintuitive, it's actually to reduce the burden on the districts to be asked so many times. It will reduce the burden on the department as well in devoting resources to that recruitment, ensure that representative samples of students are evaluated or evaluate the performance of test items and provides for other national sampling or international sampling, such as the TIMSS test that was taken just recently. And then the end of Section 5, I'm sorry, not the end, the end of page 14, also puts a retirement date on the basic skills test, as you know, which was is no longer required for students who are coming up through the system. This year's seniors are the last group that are required to pass it. And we're just looking for some opportunity to retire that test appropriately, a common practice that states will do as tests phase in and out for graduation requirements. Section 6, then, is...
Ms. Chair.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Mattson, where are we? Does the agency have a short-term solution for the grad bill? This? As we know, so many districts have been quite concerned about the number of students who will not be getting diplomas under the current status.
Dr. Mattson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, the department, as you may know, has been engaged in conversations with both senators and representatives regarding both a short-term and a long-term solution. I know that there has been some coalescence around a short-term solution, and the long-term one is yet to be decided. And I'll defer to Commissioner Segrin for further detail on that.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rummel, as you know, we are looking at both a short-term and a long-term solution. We have been working with Senator Wieger and Representative Mariani at their direction after, I think, a December joint hearing to look at both of those issues so that we can also assure that we are moving forward with measuring college and career readiness in the future and not just do a short-term solution. It sounds like and it seems like there's indication that people are not satisfied with the grad requirement in 11th grade, in an 11th grade comprehensive test. So what we've been looking for, if we're going to do any kind of transition, we need to think about what we're going to do for high school math assessment, particularly in light of what's being told to us by the at the federal level. So we're looking at end-of-course solution for math, and we are actually going to be having a symposium on March 23rd. Many of you are, and all of you are invited, in fact, legislators, for a special presentation. We have four different states that will be coming in and talking about their different methods of assessment in high school to kind of help us with that. And we're hoping that by the end of session we'll have both a short-term and a long-term solution settled on so that our folks know what to expect.
Commissioner, yes. What is the department's short-term solution?
Mr. Chair, at this point, we are still working on that with the legislature. We initially want to look at setting a cut score after we have our test data, after the students are tested this spring. So we'll set a proficiency score or a grad score. The proposal that has been talked about is to also look at if a student does not pass the grad the first time around, that there would be two opportunities, at least minimum, of two retests. And then after that, if they still fail to pass those tests, then there would be some, they would have to satisfy all of their graduation requirements in all courses and pass those. There is still some discussion about whether we want to make sure that students have maybe take another remediation type of course or satisfy some other kind of course-taking opportunities. But the governor has made it very clear to us that he not only wants a short-term solution, but he also wants a long-term so that we know where we're going to go in the future as far as measuring college and career readiness. Our math or our reading standards, or our grad that has been administered last year. Was it last year?
Yes.
78% of the students have passed that, which is the graduation rate that we have right now in Minnesota. And they have 2 years. The students have 2 years to do that, to pass that grad. So we're not very concerned about the reading because reading is kind of a skill that you use all the time. And our national folks that we've talked to said that that's probably an appropriate test and we wouldn't have to change that. But when we look at the 11th grade math comprehensive test, because kids have taken some of the subject matter, maybe in 9th grade or 10th grade, they're not being tested on current knowledge. That's why we're thinking about moving to end of course, and we would do like a geometry and an algebra 2, because as you know, algebra 2 will be required to be passed before you graduate anyway, and so that way would be a fair way of measuring students' progress towards college and career readiness. There would be the opportunity to use that as a final exam, because most of the time you have a final exam anyway. It would satisfy AYP requirements, and it would also be satisfy the grad, a grad requirement. And we also could use it as a door opener. As you know, MNSCU has now has made a uniform cut score across all of its colleges for the placement, the math placement test, and we could also do a nice crosswalk with the Algebra 2, and if a student scored a certain score, that could actually be a door opener to indicate that they would be ready for entrance-level math courses in college, whether it's a technical school or whether it's a four-year institution. So there's some nice things with doing end of course that would satisfy a lot. We could computerize it, and so teachers and students could get their results back much more quickly. So that would also indicate to teachers whether they've kind of hit the mark on certain areas in teaching geometry or algebra too. It would also give the student some indicators if they're not doing well, where they could, you know, have some remediation so that they're continuing to prepare.
Senator Rimmel.
That's kind of where we're at.
Thank you, Senator Rimmel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thank you. In the governor's proposal, is he attaching high stakes to these end-of-course tests, or has that been decided?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rimmel, in his proposal, we have not set any kind of stakes to this yet. We want to have motivated conditions for the students, and that's one of the reasons why we're having this symposium on March 23rd, is to look at what other states have done and try to thoughtfully think about how we want to have motivated conditions for our kids so that they take it seriously and yet have some fair criteria for the students. And I talked about door openers instead of door closers, but we also want to make sure that we have some criteria that does indicate that they are college ready. We don't want to have such low expectations that we're setting the student up for an expectation that they're ready, and then when they get to college, they're not. So we have to balance that, and we will be looking at that further as we, you know, come to some kind of a conclusion. But we want to do it thoughtfully.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the test that was taken last year was not high stakes from the standpoint of the grad. It didn't affect the students that took it last year. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes, the grad was not implemented or was not administered last year.
In reading
it was, but not in mathematics. This is the spring where the grad will be. Excuse me, I've got a cold. this will be the year that the grad will be embedded in the MCA 2 and will be under motivated conditions.
Yes. Yeah. So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, it'll be interesting to see whether, I presume the students knew that, whether their knowing that it wasn't high stakes was a factor in terms of the performance on those measures. And if actually knowing that it would be required for graduation, whether the performance will actually improve, concluding that the assumption and the push to going to the end of course exams is the reality that kids do forget, and if they're taking it 11th grade and they've had the courses at 9th or 10th grade, that they may not retain all of that. Mm-hmm. But you made a comment now that the higher ed, if you have good end-of-course exams, that higher ed may, in fact, recognize that instead of, adequate performance on end-of-course, instead of any pre-exams at 12th grade?
Mr. Chair, what I talked about is that right now the Accuplacer that is used by the Minsky institutions, what they have decided to do is to set a uniform cut score across all of their colleges. So, in other words, maybe St. Cloud had a different cut score for the math Accuplacer than did Normandale Community College. Well, those institutions have all decided to have the same uniform cut score. So regardless of where a student goes in Minnesota, when they take that Accuplacer math test, there is a uniform standard. What I said was that if we had an Algebra 2 end-of-course test, we could potentially, and I want to make sure that I say that, you could do a crosswalk between our Algebra 2 test, our end-of-course, that potentially we would have, and see where the Accuplacer cut score would have an equivalent comparison. And then if a student happened to score when they took that end of course at that particular cut score, that would be an indication that they would be college ready, if you will, or would have the equivalent potential of scoring the same on an acuplacer. What we would like to do then is have the discussion with MNSCU eventually that they would recognize either or. But that is done, that is in the future. My point is, what you could use an end-of-course test for is a door opener, not a door closer. You could have an indication then if a student scored well enough on this test that they have accumulated enough knowledge that they will indeed, in the MNSCU system, be eligible or able to take those beginning or level courses in math. That's what I'm saying. Those are the ways that you could use that's more positive than saying you didn't pass a certain score, so now you can't walk across the stage.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, that rationale abandons the assumption that students may forget. Because if they the end of course exam, if they perform in a way that in this crosswalk to the acuplacer measures looks fine today at the end of ninth grade or the end of 10th grade, we're asking the colleges to say, well, they did it once. Are you expecting them to perform that way again and replace the acuplacer that particular exam? So we're not being consistent if we, in now, saying that we want to go to the end-of-course exam because kids forget, then assume that they won't forget when they have to take the pre-college test.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, and I think we do need to move on. Actually, we don't have the end-of-course language in here.
She doesn't have to answer.
It was, I know.
It's raising the issue, though.
Very good points and things that we have to address before we put our final package together. But
Mr. Chair, I'll just answer very quickly. With end of course, what's nice about that is you have students that can be accelerated math students that could take an Algebra 2 or a Geometry whenever they're ready for it. But the assumption is that those students are going to go on and take more math courses. And, in fact, I think the university is considering requiring 4 years of math to get into their institution. They're talking about that. For those students that are not on as rapid a track, they may take their Algebra 2 course their junior or senior year. So I think it's going to depend on what track the student is in. And so I don't think that there is much of a concern with whether they're ready. If a student is planning on going to a technical school, they have to take Algebra 2 to graduate from high school. They may take that in their junior or senior year. So I think there's a lot of flexibility with it.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we should move on. We have scheduled a number of bills tomorrow, and I'm not sure we're going to get through this. Senator Wieger?
Dr. Mattson has the next section as well.
Okay, Dr. Mattson.
And Mr. Chair, it is very brief. A technical change at the top of 17, which is just allowing ninth grade students to take the biology assessment if they take that course in ninth grade. It's simply a technical change allowing anywhere within the high school realm, 9 through 12, for students to participate in that assessment. I will make way for the next testifier.
Sparnage, sections 7 and 8.
Okay.
Extension what?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, section 7 and 8.
Page 17.
Oh, sorry, yes. Page 17 and going over on to page 18 are for the Board of Teaching. They requested that we included this in our bill. It allows teachers who serve on the Board of Teaching, if they retire during the term on the board, to continue out the rest of their term. These are just two sections of where that change needs to be made in statute. This allows for continuity for the board. In the past, I believe 10 years, three teachers have retired during their term, and their terms are, I believe, 4 years. But the Board of Teaching is in the audience as well and does support this, and hopefully that's it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. Beginning with Section 9, you'll see throughout Article 2 a lot of clarification language with regard to alternative programs to clarify the terminology that's used by the department and in the alternative program community more widely to make clear that under the umbrella of state-approved alternative programs, there are really three types of programs: area learning centers, which is how they're most commonly referred to, but represent only one type of alternative program that usually serves multiple districts or multiple schools, and that in addition, there are also alternative learning programs usually within a school and contracted alternatives, which really only exist, I believe, currently in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts. That clarification language you'll also find in Sections 10 and Sections 11. One of the changes that was in the author's amendment was at the top of 21, line 21.1 at the top of page 21, where we made clear that the Job Training Partnership Act is actually called the Workforce Investment Act now, that particular federal law. Section 12 deals with when on line 21.13 deals with when a school district proposes to temporarily close a schoolhouse or lease the facility to another entity for use as a schoolhouse for three or fewer years. As long as they hold a public meeting and allow public comment on the schoolhouse's future, they do not need to comply with all of the requirements in Subdivision 5, including a public hearing. This was a request that came to us from the St. Paul School District and other school districts. Section 13 begins several sections that deal with the current online learning law. And for those of you that were at a hearing, I believe it was last week, this language is essentially identical to the language in Senator Saxhog's bill modifying the current online learning law. I'll be happy to answer questions. I won't go through that in detail. It clarifies what section of the bill is applying to supplemental online learning. It clarifies the kind of reporting and information that needs to be made to this resident school district of a student upon request of that resident school district when their student is enrolled part-time in online learning from a certified provider. And it also clarifies and adds some new requirements regarding what an online learning provider has to provide to the department to be certified statewide as an online learning provider. That takes us up through Section 16, beginning on line 25.15, which reestablishes the Online Learning Advisory Council, which was originally created by the legislature and then sunsetted last year, I believe. And again, one of the amendments in the A2 amendment deleted on line 25.18, deleted the part where it says established under Section 15059. That section requires that councils established in that section can get per diems and other kinds of mileage expenses, and the department's intent was not to create a cost when we reestablished this council, although we think it is a valuable council for the department, for the commissioner to have, that we did not create a mandatory cost by referencing that section.
There's a couple of other advisory councils that are in here. One on the charter schools, one on the online learning. And what we're really doing is just kind of moving the sunset out a few years. And it seems like that wouldn't make it eligible to necessarily go to the state and local government. I'm not sure. I don't serve on that committee, but it seems like the extension of an existing advisory council is different than creating a new advisory council.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm looking to somebody who might be on that committee.
Mr. Chair, I don't remember extending councils in the committee, but we do have overview whenever anyone is establishing a board or task force or commission. But I don't necessarily remember extending the dates.
Yeah, I don't either, but it seems like that would be odd to, you know, if you wanted to extend something for a year, I'll have to check with Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, if it helps clarify, this extension of the Online Learning Advisory Council was in the bill last year, and I believe ended up in the final policy bill, and I don't remember that it was referred to that committee last year when it was considered.
What happened to that bill?
I believe that bill was vetoed, Mr. Chairman.
And we couldn't get the House to go along with.
Okay.
That was the overall policy.
All right. Maybe I'll have to talk to the governor.
Mr. Chairman, beginning in Section 17 on the top of page 26, this is a fairly lengthy section which lays out the department's initial proposal for strengthening the charter school law. And it does a couple of things primarily. One is to implement the recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor that they made in their report of last year. And in addition, provides some clarification in a number of other sections where there has either been confusion in the law or there was a feeling that the law was vague in its wording, to make clear particularly what statutes do apply to charter schools. It wasn't my intent, unless, Mr. Chairman, you wish me to do so, to actually walk through this section in detail, because I know you're going to be having hearings with regards to charter school bills specifically, but I'll leave that up to the discretion
of... For members' information, there has been a group that has been meeting on charter schools, and so this language isn't identical to, I think, the language that they have come up with. So there's some differences. The one thing that, when I was reading through this, and maybe it's just the fact that some of us have been here long enough to go back to when charter schools actually started, but we're so comfortable with sponsor versus authorizer. I mean, it's like the enforcer. I mean, why would you want to change something that's kind of a given in the community?
Mr. Chairman, you're very right. The term sponsor, referring to that entity which actually, as it does say in the statute, authorizes the school to initially open. It goes back to the original enactment of the charter school law, and, of course, Minnesota was the first state. Frankly, most other states, I believe there are only two other states out of the 40 states and District of Columbia, use any term besides authorizer, and that really has become the more commonly accepted term. And when the charter school community got together with the department and talked about improvements they wanted to make in the law, I think the charter school community and the charter school association in particular said, we don't really feel the term sponsor embodies what we want these organizations to do. It sounds like a supporting organization. Organization provides financial assistance, whereas authorizer really implies... says what the body, what the entity does originally, and also implies more of an oversight role, an ongoing oversight role. And so as we were implementing the legislative auditor's recommendations, which were really primarily about strengthening sponsors or authorizers and giving them more accountability and responsibility, it made sense to switch that terminology as well, because there's been a lot of confusion actually about the sponsor term.
Well, maybe Senator Olson and I can get together and come up with something that's more accepting, I think, of what we're trying to do. So I think the we'll have a more thorough discussion of this. The concern that I would lay out is, I think that there's a number of things that the department and the legislative auditor and I think general concerns about rapid growth of charter schools that we've maybe lost a little bit of the connection, I think, between the state and the what's happening, in our education, charter school or alternative type education systems. And I'm hoping whatever we come up with brings us closer to recognizing that these are public schools just like any other public school. I mean, not that they're the same kind, but it seems like the adversarial relationship has gotten much more deep-rooted, and it shouldn't. And I, you know, we want alternatives, but we don't want to have two diverse public education complete systems. I mean, we all operate under the same tax dollars, and the goal is always the same, is to try to drive student achievement and accountability, and that's really what we're after. And I think when I was going through this, a lot of the changes do go in that direction, which is I think a very positive thing.
Mr. Chairman, I was just I have some friends in California. One is a principal of a school near elementary school near Sacramento, and they have implemented the chartering notion more in a way I think it was first envisioned, and it's right within the system. It's not separate, so that the school that he is the principal of has a charter school within it. And now I'd gotten wind that he was actually being recruited because of his experience with the chartering and the regular, with a district that has one school that is a charter. And because he has that experience, might be the new leader of that particular school. But it's there. It's just like a district, only it just happens to be chartered. So that distinction or that stigma that somehow this is different or it's competitive or whatever doesn't appear to be operating out there. So I thought that was quite interesting to learn. Because we still haven't, even though I think that was part of the vision, is that the teachers and others that wanted to try a different approach and give them some flexibility, that could happen right within a school district rather than it necessarily having to be developed outside of that experience of that people, everybody feels is competitive with it. So hopefully we can build some bridges back into the system as well.
Senator Saltzman.
And all those points, Mr. Chair, and I think you brought up some excellent points, Senator Olson, is that we really want to build our entire public school system. And I think that the country has learned a lot from Minnesota, but now we can learn from our growth and some of our growing pains, but I'll also look at what people are doing in other parts of the country. And Chicago has taken, you know, the charter school concept and really embedded it as part of their public school system and having oversight by the school district, and that they see it as an option. And so, you know, over the past few days, as we've gotten some very good reaction to our bill from many different stakeholder groups, that there's been a renewed interest in looking at some of the other proposals that are out there. And I hope that we can have that discussion of how we strengthen all schools. But schools that are working really well, our charter schools that are performing well, are also feeling as if some of the pieces in this bill are going to be a burden to them. And I really want to listen to those schools that have been very, very successful that in trying to deal with schools that need some more direction, that we don't hold back schools that are working well. And I think we've had that discussion in this committee regarding some of the mandate reductions on schools. So I really want to, work on that and keep student achievement, accountability, and results is really our focus. And I think if we can do that, we can come up with a very good bill that I believe all stakeholder groups can find some consensus on.
Senator Barnoff.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brown, I have a question for you. We've seen so many different bills in the working group that they all begin to blend together. And so I'm going through this trying to find where you've put in the governance section, and I don't see it because I know that was one of the key legislative auditors' concerns, and I'm just wondering what the governor's policy bill is in regards to the boards. As you probably remember, I have a keen interest in that subject.
Page 27, 14. Mr.
Brown? Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, there's some language in 4A with regard to the conflict of interest recommendations and the governance concerns. There's not language in our proposal regarding the legislative auditor's recommendation that a teacher majority board no longer be required. We knew that the Charter School Association was coming forward with its proposal to try to get that discussion moving. As you know, we've had that discussion for a number of years on and off, and it hasn't seemed to go much of anywhere. And so we deferred to the Charter School Association that they would bring together kind of a more innovative proposal to try to address that recommendation.
Senator Baja.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brown, I would suggest that leadership on behalf of the governor's office would be a positive step in setting forward new policy, because I have found when I try and raise this issue, I do get a lot of resistance from various groups, and I think it's been raised in the legislative auditor's report as one of the key issues. And so I would like you to consider staking out some pretty strong ground in that area.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bob, just there's no confusion. The governor and the department strongly support the recommendation that the legislative auditor made, that a teacher majority board no longer be required, as we did back when they originally made that recommendation in their 2003 report. So it's something we've supported for 5 or 6 years. We're just trying to think of some ways to get that discussion moving in a direction, whereas before it's really never gone anywhere. It's kind of come to a halt.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Brown.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, continuing on to page 42, Section 18 deals with some changes to the section of the law that deals with payment of aid to charter schools, which, again, I think you'll probably get discussed when charter school bills come forward. I do want to make clear that none of these changes has a cost associated with them, and that's why they are in the policy bill. Section 19 and Section 20 and Section 21 all deal, again, with clarifications regarding state-approved alternative programs, clarifying language there. With the exception of one substantive change, and again, this was addressed in the A2 amendment, if you go to line 4513 under Clause 2, the A2 amendment deletes at least 1 year. And the reason for this is this deals with this in combination with Clause 6 about the appropriate referral of students to alternative programs really is more consistent with what the practice is in the field, frankly, at this point, which is to not necessarily wait until a child is a full year behind in completing coursework, but if it's identified that the student is falling behind and could benefit from an alternative program, that you, under Clause 6, they would be appropriately referred to an alternative program. Section 22, again, provides some clarifying language. At the top of page 46, just makes the language here with regard to allowing alternative programs to participate in PSEO, the language that makes sure that the language is consistent with the PSEO law itself. I think, Section 23 and 24 also are clarifying language on alternative programs. Section 25 and also 26 deal with students in care and treatment programs. If you go to line 47.7, ensuring that if the district that is placing the student in a care and treatment program is other than the resident district, that there is an opportunity for the resident district to participate in that placement discussion, and there's some language there. And then if you go down to paragraph C, beginning on line 47.16, that when a child is temporarily placed for care and treatment in a day program, that the resident district may establish reasonable restrictions on transportation unless it's a court-ordered placement. Providing some opportunity for the resident district to have some input there as well.
Mr. Chair.
Do you have any idea what percentage are court-ordered and what percentage would be not?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that information with me, but we'd be happy to get it for you.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to the top of page 46, and we're eliminating the age and just putting in a high school junior or senior. I know there's a bill floating around that drops the age or the grade level for post-secondary. I'm not sure if it's 9th and 10th grade or just 10th grade, but a lot of 10th graders are 16 years old, but I know traditionally it has only been juniors and seniors. But I'm wondering, and I signed on to the bill because I think of it as sort of a program for the gifted. that if it would be with, I believe, the language of the bill, and we haven't heard it yet, but the language of the bill indicates that they would have to have sign-off by other teachers that they would be prepared to take a post-secondary course. But in this day of shrinking resources when you know, we may not have as many programs for the gifted, I would like the department to think about the possibility of offering post-secondary courses, AP, College in the Schools, International Baccalaureate, to 10th graders at least. And that there would be a sign-off that they're ready to take it, but at least an opportunity for that.
Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, to my knowledge, the department has not taken a position on that bill. Colleagues will correct me if that's not correct, but I will take that back and see if the department has reviewed that bill and whether we're interested in taking a position on that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Moving on to Section 26 on page 48. This deals with the placement of children without disabilities in care and treatment programs, and the language there is very similar to, and the intent is similar to, the language I just referenced. And then I'm going to have Dr. Melcher come up to discuss Section 27 and possibly Section 28 as well.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Do I see?
Mr. Chairman, if Dr. Melcher's not in the room, he and I did chat about this.
Okay.
Maybe have Mr. Brown speak to the intent of the provision, and then I can walk through the technical amendment that Dr. Melcher is recommending.
I can speak on Section 28. I'm going to have to defer to you on Section 27. It's a fairly technical piece of changing in the funding formula.
Okay. So Mr. Chairman and members, Section 27, as I understand it, is attempting to conform the calculations for the learning year pupil unit to the changes that are happening elsewhere in the bill on the ALCs. And if you move to page 51, that's going to be where the amendment is. What's happening here is they're making an adjustment for the amount of dollars. We calculate the dollars for the kids based on the average general education revenue per pupil unit. And then they are currently, under current law, we're subtracting off compensatory. The proposal in the department's bill is to subtract off an amount that would also include basic skills and the transportation sparsity revenue, and that's what that 4.85% is referencing on line 51.3. That's part of the calculation that we do for transportation sparsity. The operative confusion results on lines 51.9 and 51.10. The intent here is to show to make reference to an allocation, and the language that reads according to Section 126C10 sub 4 is actually a calculation of a revenue stream and not an allocation line. So, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher is recommending that the language that reads according to Section 126C10 subdivision 4 be moved up to line 51.9 after revenue, and then replace it on line 51.10 with to the program. So the new sentence would read basic skills revenue according to Section 126C10 subdivision 4, comma, generated by pupils attending the eligible program must be allocated to the program. And by making that change, we are making it clear that we are talking about an allocation and not how the dollars are actually calculated.
If that isn't an amendment, I'd move that.
Senator Olson moves that amendment.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, we'd like to make that same change on lines 51.25 and 51.26.
Okay.
So according to Section 126C10 sub 4 would follow revenue, and replacing it on 51.26 with to the program.
Okay, Senator Olson incorporates that into her amendment. Are there only two places?
Just those two places, Mr. Chairman. I see Dr. Melcher's come back into the room. He may want to speak more broadly about the intent of the overall provision.
Okay, any other discussion? Sorry. I think we are carrying your water, Dr. Melcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that.
On that, Mr. Nauman explained why we need to make that amendment. So on Senator Olson's amendment, any other discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, in Section 28, top of page 52, currently in law, there is a way for schools or programs to apply to the commissioner to be approved for having their ADMs calculated based on have project-based ADMs, which is based not on seat time but on actual completion of projects for project-based programs. This has some language in clarifying and strengthening those provisions, and this is most important, of course, when we have to audit these programs to make sure that students are completing the coursework. On sections 29 and 30 are revival and reenactment provisions for the Online Learning Advisory Council and the Charter School Advisory Council.
Can you give me an example of the project-based average daily membership, you know, like where it's used? Is it used in magnet schools, or is it used in some other?
Mr. Chairman, you can find project-based schools, frankly, in district schools, charter schools, magnet schools. We're seeing them in a number of different situations. About what caused this originally to be included in the law was when we would have to audit one of those programs, and these programs don't work particularly well if you're trying to audit them in terms of seat time or hours. They work much better if you're saying, if the program is saying we expect students to complete X number of projects in a semester, and here's how many they've actually completed. And so it made it much easier for auditing purposes, and really was recognizing the purpose and intent of those programs in terms of how they chose to educate students.
Okay. Right.
Mr. Chair, Articles 3 and 4 will be presented by Ms. Barnage. Mr. Brown may be available for Section 3 on a technical point if necessary. Ms. Barnage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Trying to go through this quickly for you, Article 3, Section 1 is actually aligning a parental notification for school districts to notify parents when their student is enrolled in a limited English language learning program. And this is actually a federal requirement that it be 30 days. By aligning with the federal requirements, we take some of the burden off of the school district and some of the confusion on is it 10 or is it 30. We'll just align with the federal requirements that they have till 30 days to notify parents. Section 2 is actually the very last line on page 54. We're just asking to have our state interagency coordinating councils extended. This is a federal requirement for early childhood special education that we have these councils to appropriate funds. And Section 3 is a trial placement for students who whose parents would like to enroll their students in one of the state academies if they are deaf or hard of hearing or blind or visually impaired without actually having an IEP that allows for that trial placement. This was a request from some parents and from the academies to have this type of language. Section 4 is removes a cap instated in 1997 for administrative costs retained by the Department of Human Services for reimbursements to school districts for special education services under medical assistance. The Department of Human Services has requested this removal of the cap for several years. It was in last year's omnibus bill that was they request it due to the increasing costs of salaries and benefits from inflations and union negotiations. Again, that cap was set in 1997. That's Article 3. Is there
a couple questions?
Yes.
On the trial placement under Section 3, so that can't occur unless we have this new language?
Mr. Chairman, uh-huh. Correct. Under the current language for the two state academies, the only way a child can be enrolled there is through a referral from a school district based on their IEP that was developed with that district. And we had both the academies, a number of parents came and said that there are situations where they would like the option to be able to enroll their child there directly. And so this was language worked out by the academies and their legal counsel to provide that option, but also ensure by having this 60-day trial placement that it was an appropriate placement for that child to be in one of the two academies.
On the Section 4, Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about the fact that we have completely stricken the not to exceed $350,000 per fiscal year because given the cost of medical care for some of these special ed services, it seems like we're putting ourselves at risk by having no cap. Would we be better off to figure out what the appropriate number is and put that in there? And then if you carry that thought through, the line above it says minus up to 5% retained by the Commissioner of Human Services for administrative costs. I mean, imagine if you've got a very large amount of money there and that we've just said, that up to 5%. It seems like we don't have the proper kind of checks and balances in that section.
Dr. Brown or Ms. Barbage?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, this, again, was a request from the Department of Human Services. I believe they are also carrying it in their bill. The 5% does, in a sense, allow for a cap, but as you note, I'm not for sure at this point how extensive that could be. But we were just trying to help the Department of Human Services as well in their effort to ensure that they're also retaining the costs to cover their salaries and inflation since 1987 cap.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that is the best way to do it, so I'm wondering if we could revisit that.
Sure.
So, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Allen.
As I understand Senator Bono's concern, perhaps it would be more appropriate for the department to get back to us with what, if this number is constraining, perhaps we'd have a better sense of what a proper number might be. Maybe it's 500, maybe it's a million. I don't know what it would be, but then we would retain the intent of the original language was just a new number. In other words, we could strike the old number and put something else in, which would provide the Department of Education a little bit of assurance that it's not going to exceed a certain amount.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Brunage?
The department would be happy to consult with the Department of Human Services as well and get back to you on an amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think if we had a better understanding, because we aren't dealing with the federal share of the, medical assistance. I'm sure there's certain qualifications or certain services that are, that are part of it for these students, and 5% may be inappropriate. I mean, 5% for administration isn't that out of line. If it's just a big, huge pot of money that we're looking at, that's one thing, but I would think it would be the amount of money expended for those specific students that happen to come out of that pot. So it would be helpful to have that information, have a clearer picture of what it is they're doing, and it may be more comforting that this would be appropriate language to have.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a point of information. And when a student's costs exceed whatever the cap might be, who picks up the difference?
The taxpayers.
I don't know. Well, my question goes back to our special ed bill a few years ago. Are the school districts picking up the difference for the costs that are not covered?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Barnage.
It's my understanding that this is a cap of what the Department of Human Services can keep from the amounts that they're giving back to the school districts. So actually it would be the Department of Human Services that would be eating the costs that aren't covered in this. which would be their concern.
Is now you said that, or this is also in the Human Services bill?
Yes.
That,
Mr. Chair.
And why would it be there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm because they requested it, but I'm not for sure what gives them the authority to amend this statute under our. Yes, if you don't mind, the commissioner.
It looks like an education statute.
Yeah, maybe I can help clear this up. Mr. Chair, Commissioner Segrin, Alice Segrin. This is in regard to third-party billing, and what happens is school districts are eligible to apply to cover some of the health-related costs that a student might receive in their schools. And so there's a process that you have to submit the bill to the Department of Human Services. And the Human Services has all sorts of criteria that they have to follow with federal guidelines. It's a really complicated process. Many school districts have given up even trying to do third-party billing, but others have been quite successful in getting medical assistance paid for, the health portion paid for by Human Services. And we have an interagency agreement with Human Services and the Department of Education in trying to get some of this billed or actually paid for by medical assistance. Otherwise, what happens is our school districts pick up a lot of those health-related costs, and so we've been trying for years to get the federal government to recognize some of these health-related costs. So that's kind of where this is at, and apparently Human Services it's a pretty complex process to get this done, and apparently they're asking that the cap be taken off because of the cost incurred of trying to get this all of this processed. I think that the discussion about should we look at a different cost figure in here would be fine instead of just a 5%. So we'll be glad to do that, but it isn't. That's why it's entwined with us is that we have these interagency agreements to try to get billing for paying for some of these costs.
Commissioner, the $350,000 mm-hmm. is really the 5%, correct?
Mr. Chair, I am not sure if that was the equivalent of what I'm trying to understand. I understand the process. I'm not sure that the 350 was the equivalent of 5%. It might have been years ago. I don't know. Where I think you need Human Services here to maybe answer that question, or we can follow up for you.
And, yeah, I think it would be. I mean, it is good to try to have our districts reimbursed for those costs, right. and if that $350 is not covering their administrative costs, then it, you know, maybe they're way over that amount. I mean, what do we spend $1.2 billion in special ed? I think both parts of it.
Mr. Chair, I think we just need to ask Human Services what a realistic cost might be, what their 5%.
Sure.
Might be because I think what we need to know is what the total amount that is being collected on third-party billing, first of all, and see how intense it is. It's a pretty intense process to try to get these third-party billing payments.
Why? I mean, just removing this doesn't facilitate that third-party billing. But are there other things that could be facilitated so that districts would be less? Would be more likely to do it?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. There's been a lot of training provided to school districts to help them to apply for third-party billing payments. And some school districts have a really, pretty good process. It just depends on the numbers of students you have. I think some of the larger school districts may have the ability to, have the staff, to go through this process. But I know that both DHS and the Department of Education have provided a number of trainings over the years to help facilitate that. But again, it kind of falls back to human services as far as what the federal government will allow as far as charge, you know, allowable charges for health services. But we'll try to find out more information for you as so that you can have a better sense of what you want to do with this.
All right. Thank you. Senator Bonner?
Mr. Chairman, and the more I've read the section, the more I think I understand what it's trying to accomplish, that basically the school districts are enrolling as medical assistance providers, and they're submitting the paperwork to the department. The department is doing the administrative work to try and get the reimbursement and then taking a fee for doing that work. But I would still say that that the fee being a percentage of what the total reimbursement is might not be the right calculation, because we're talking about a reimbursement of medical services versus what administrative technical help costs. And so it seems like that's not maybe the proper formula for which to reimburse the Department of Health and Human Services. So I would question that as well, because if we take this percentage out, if we weren't taking that amount, then the remainder would go back to reimbursing school districts. So I think it is something that we want to have more understanding on that formula.
All right. Thank you. We continue.
Article 4, libraries. We'll return to Ms. Barnage.
Ms. Barnage.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Article 4 just has two sections, and they both deal with what is currently known now as the blind and physically handicapped library. The library is requesting to have their name amended to what is how it is currently known by its patron, and how it that fulfills its purpose a little better. In Section 2, the library is also asking for the ability to have telephone or electronic meetings for their advisory committee. The library is located in Faribault, and currently they have quarterly meetings either in Roseville at the Department of Education or in Faribault, but its members are physically handicapped and hard of hearing and have to and are dispersed throughout the state and have to travel, and this is difficult for them sometimes. So what they're just asking if the meeting fulfills all these requirements, to still allow it to be a public meeting, if they could have their meetings held either by telephone or electronic. Other advisory councils or committees also currently have this ability. The State Rehabilitation Council for the Blind, Statewide Independent Living Council, and the Minnesota Veterans Home Board of Directors also currently have this ability. I believe there's also a bill currently up for the Indian Affairs Council requesting similar abilities.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if there's an answer to this. I've had a number of constituents call me or talk to me about the staffing at this library.
I can't.
And saying that it's not fully staffed, and so it takes a long time for them to get the information. Can you help me understand what the staffing situation is at the library?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Brunage?
What I do know, and I'm sorry, I may not be fully informed on everything, but there was either a retirement or someone who did leave the position at the library, I think this winter. I don't know if it was November or December. And due to the hiring freeze of the state, we have not been able to fulfill that position since.
Members, just a comment on committee decorum. When you speak, if you would speak into your microphone so that we can capture the recording, and then also at the front table, be sure that the mics are fairly close so that it does magnify.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's also important that we've been instructed when this was installed that we are not to move these mics because it does damage. Senator Rummel's mic is not working right now, and I know I witnessed when that has been moved back and forth, and it damages the connection. So if people would just leave the mics where they are, I think it would help the maintenance of our of our facility. The House members come with a bad habit because they have a different system and they're always pushing their things out of the way. So it's that's important to remember, too, because your mic is not working right now. I can tell point, because I'm listening.
Point well taken. So, all right.
Mr. Chair, Article 5 has some early childhood community ed provisions. Ms. Carlson.
Yes. Mr. Chair and members, Section 1 of Article 5, and want to refer to your amendment also.
Okay, and be sure you move that microphone over so that we can all hear you.
It's a problem about being short. Tell me. Anyway, in Section 1, two budget sessions ago in 2005, language was added to the ECFE statute requiring to begin in 2011 that ECFE programs would have to submit biennial plans to the department, but there was no appropriation. Got a little snafu there in the middle of the night on the appropriation. And so we're asking that those plans not start to be submitted because we don't have any administrative money to automate the plans. The language in front of you on the bill, you need to look at the amended language on lines 1.30 to 2.14 through 2.14. So we're not, you can see in item B, we are leaving that language alone. That's something that ECFE has been doing since 1983. Section 2 is all new language. It's a definition that the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education jointly put together. There's lots of ongoing and current discussion about the early childhood system, this and that and the other thing, and we thought maybe we would get together and propose this definition to be comprehensive and clarifying to the discussions. Section 3. We're starting some revisions to school readiness program that's in the community ed departments of the districts. And subdivision 3 further clarifies the purpose of the school readiness program in that it is to prepare children for kindergarten, especially those at risk for being most unprepared for kindergarten. And in Section 4, we start the program requirements. Most of these are minor revisions. However, there's a couple that I want to point out that are not minor revisions. And the first
Excuse
one
me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, and I know that we don't have much time, so I hate to belabor things, but going back to the definition, Ms. Carlson, I noticed there's no mention of family in the definition, and so if we are going to institute a definition of an early learning system, which I think is a good thing, I think because we've all been so clear about the importance of including families in the early learning system, that it ought to in some way incorporate that.
Are you looking, Senator Bonhoff, in Section 2?
Yes.
I think we could probably try to simplify that first sentence to, what is it, about six lines long?
Yes. That's what happens when you work with two departments on a comprehensive link.
So we'll take a look at that.
Thank you.
Well, I think we need to remember that we are a citizen legislature and we're not all specialists, and the other people will be reading this for meaning. So, okay, Ms. Carlson.
All right, back to Section 4. I wanted to point out two substantive changes. First one on line 58.12, number 9, which is a requirement to serve children a minimum of 12 hours a week in a school readiness program. And currently we have no hour requirement. There's a lot of current research that says there's a certain kind of threshold of dosage for children, if you will, for children who are at risk for being unprepared for kindergarten, and 12 hours is the bottom of that threshold. So And we realize that there will be programs that will have to make program changes to accommodate this. However, we felt it was important to come forward and say that programs that are having a lower dosage really aren't getting to those children that we've identified in the purpose. So, but we know there'll be a trade-off here for numbers of children served. And I believe you have a testifier that'll talk about that. The other change of substance is on the amendment, and that is on lines 2.22 and 2.3 of the amendment. We've never had teacher qualifications for school readiness teachers before. To compare in ECFE, the teachers have to be licensed. So we're not suggesting that here, but we are proposing that the teachers be knowledgeable in three areas: curriculum, content, assessment, and instruction.
How are you,
Mr. Chairman?
I think, again, this we need to think. I mean, we all want qualified teachers and everything, but you know, we want to also know what the impacts are going to be out there in the district. So, Senator Terezri.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to add some language to Section 4 to suggest some language. I hope you're in agreement with this, Ms. Carlson, in Section 5.
Senator Terezri, could you be sure to speak into the microphone, because our council is leaning into...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this better? I don't know if this is working for me. It is. Thank you. In line 5727, in program requirements, the new language, I would like to add with a comprehensive, culturally relevant child assessment instrument. And on subdivision 10,
just
teachers.
A second. You might have to repeat that first amendment.
Where is it? As 5727, subdivision 3 and 1, it says assess each child's cognitive skills with a comprehensive, culturally relevant child assessment instrument.
Right here. 57.27.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I will, if we have time, I would like to explain. We have many children. If the goal of the department is to ensure the children that are at most risk for being unprepared for kindergarten, we need to acknowledge the issue affecting many immigrant children who come here who do not speak English and do not recognize many of the images that are being presented to them in the current system, and I think Ms. Carlson understands that. So I think that there is a need for adapting and recognizing that for young children, having a person who speaks the language is a very important issue, and who also recognize images that are familiar to the culture of the child.
Mr. Chair, that's a friendly amendment.
Okay. Subdivision 4, right?
Section 4.
Clause 1, after comprehensive, insert culturally relevant. On that, anyone? Question? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that there is a... I need to figure out how to do the same thing if I do it for the instrument, because that will apply. Staff came to advise me on that. I think that was the same thing. The second one, Mr. Chairman, is on 5815, line 5815, subdivision 10. Teachers, a school board must employ necessary qualified teachers trained in early childhood curriculum content, cultural competency. I would like to insert, instruction and competency as determined by the commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I believe the A2 amendment deleted
provision.
Oh, sorry.
Deleted that section.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, the new language is on the amendment. on lines 2.22 and 2.23.
Okay. What the amendment does is it deletes subdivision 10, and it also
thank you.
Inserts 10, which is have teachers knowledgeable in early childhood curriculum content assessment and instructions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that would be appropriate if I could incorporate into 10, have teachers knowledgeable in early childhood curriculum content, cultural competency, comma, assessment, and instruction.
Take it.
Okay, Senator Wieger
accepts
that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Wieger.
The only thing that I'm questioning is about how this ends up applying in districts that only have students that, like one student that speaks a different language. And I heard Senator Torres Rey say she wanted to make sure that they were tested in their own language, for example, or assessed in their own language. What kind of a burden? I don't know. I'm not quite sure what you mean by culturally relevant. But I'm just wondering what kind of a burden this might place on some of our smaller districts in particular.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Treasury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Roblin. My hope is that since we are trying to encourage school districts to cooperate to purchase things, maybe we can encourage them to cooperate to assess children in a more competent way so that we don't leave those children behind even when they are only one. So my understanding is that schools already do that, and this will be an excellent opportunity maybe for me to work with Senator Bonoff to figure out how they can contract services to serve that one child.
Okay, Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Torres Rey also wanted us to look at some language regarding instructional practice, and perhaps staff could look at some language as we revisit this later. That would be our intent. And I'll ask Ms. Carlson to please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, one more section I have here is Section 6. And you have had discussions in here, I think, about pre-K allowances and the quality rating system. Last session we talked about that. And this, to remind you, in that quality rating system, Head Start programs and accredited child care center programs receive an automatic 4-star rating, which is the highest rating. The school districts have, in the pilot, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Blue Earth Nicollet, have had issues with their rating. They were given 3 stars. And so with the change in these requirements, it certainly brings them to a 4-star level. And so you'll see the language then gives them the 4 stars through the term of the pilot project. And that concludes.
Barnage.
Mr. Chair, right, members of the committee, trying to finish out the rest of Article 5, Section 7 is trying to align statute with current practice by deleting the requirement for the Department of Education to maintain a list of acceptable youth programs. Over the last 7 to 8 years, the list has not been used or referenced by school districts and has become an obsolete requirement. Section 8 removes the requirement for community education annual reports for the community education to report annually on one specific data element, and that is the cost per participant or cost per contact hour. They still have to do the annual report, but together the Department of Ed with MCEA is asking to have this one data element stricken because it is a cumbersome data element for them to try to calculate, as well as with all the different types of services they provide, it is somewhat of an irrelevant number. They could be providing intensive or extensive services to one person and just a couple hours to another. So you're just kind of getting an average of all the variety of services they provide. Section 9 is increasing the cap on supplemental service grants for ABE. Since this cap was put in, the ABE funding has more than doubled. So instead of having a cap of $100,000, we're asking to have it to be 20% of the total grant funds available. This allows us to maximize the effectiveness of these funds by allowing a provider to offer more services of specific content areas that are needed, instead of trying to provide multiple or find multiple providers of the same service, just allowing us to have a larger grant to a provider to cover those services. Sections 9 and 10 are removing the school and community advisory team that is no longer required federally. This was a federal requirement before No Child Left Behind, but with No Child Left Behind, this...
Excuse me.
Senator Bonhoeff.
I think we went over there's an area we passed over that we wanted to do that amendment on page 67.
Actually, currently I'm on page 6D.
61.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said section 9 and 10, which I see on 68. I was in the wrong section. I apologize.
I'm sorry. Thank you, though.
You're ahead of us.
Sorry for interrupting.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Going on page 61, section 10 and 11, although I have 9 and 10. So we're just asking to have this requirement removed for the school districts. Again, it's not federally required anymore. They do have processes in place for the assessments that they do still need to do, but the actual advisory team has no funding linked to it. So just requesting that be removed. On the repealer, it repeals the actual language for the community advisory team. The amendment also shows we had, in the original bill, accidentally repealed the ECFE report, which Ms. Carlson just said that was an accident on our part. So the amendment reinstates the ECFE report. Article 6, just moving on. This is language that, after consulting with Minnesota Management and Budget, helps clarify that the department is allowed to apply for and accept grants. Other state agencies have this ability. We have it. We've been using a different statute to allow us to apply for grants and accept them. But to provide further clarification, Minnesota Management and Budget has suggested that we include this language, which is identical to language throughout statutes for other state agencies as well.
You think you could tell the legislature what you're doing with those grants?
It's actually a general purpose. So it would depend. I mean, we have grants for special education policy grants. We have it would go across the board for all the different things that the department does.
We might want to put some language in there to just alert the legislature what all the grants that you make.
That could be a cumbersome report, Mr. Chair. But again, this is just language that other agencies also have. For some reason, the Department of Ed didn't have this language as well.
Mr. Chair, in the home stretch, Article 7 has some technical corrections. We'll start with Dr. Mattson.
Dr. Mattson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dirk Mattson for the department. Hopefully these are brief technical changes regarding assessment. The change in Section 1 around line 62.18 is just making a cross-reference appropriate to where most of the assessment statute is. It's pulling out assessment language and putting it all in one place to eliminate trying to keep track of both those references. Section 2 and 3 deal with updated language strike-throughs regarding exemptions for students with disabilities. This is not allowed either under IDEA or under NCLB. Those students have alternative assessments that they can take, and that is the current practice now, and we're just clarifying that language. That is Section 2 and 3 takes you through page 65. And then the final one, Section 4, is a recommendation to remove the language about the commissioner making statistical adjustments for residential instability, number of single-parent family, parents' level of education, et cetera. These are items that the department does not collect and probably be prohibited by law to collect those, and so asking to clarify that. And that's the end for me.
Section 5, Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Section 5 is correcting a cross-reference relating to special education aid. Section 6 is updating the statute relating to the duties of the school board clerk to reflect timelines in other statutes. Section 7 through 9 are eliminating obsolete language dealing with the old statutory operating debt calculations from 1977.
There. Section 10.
Mr. Chair, excuse me.
Senator Maher.
Mr. Chair, this is where the amendment that I was referring to comes in. On page 67, line 67.26, we want to delete state board. We no longer have that, and insert instead pursuant where it says pursuant to Chapter 14, and instead insert commissioner. So delete the by the state board pursuant to Chapter 14, and instead it would be insert commissioner by the commissioner.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Morgan Brown with the Education Department.
Oh, we better act on that.
Yeah, I move that.
Okay. Senator Bonhoff moves the amendment to delete state board and insert commissioner. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Section 10.
Mr. Chairman, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. Section 10 clarifies the original intent of the online learning law that full-time providers of online learning who wish to provide online learning to students in other districts, and this would also include charter schools, do have to be certified under the online learning law to provide online learning. And then Section 11 just makes clear that with regard to an audit report, that it if the commissioner receives an audit report as opposed to a management letter indicating material weaknesses. That, this is on line 70.7.
Dr. Melcher will take the remaining four sections.
Mr. Chairman, remember Section 12 is clarifying language relating to the academies to specify that grants and gifts must be used for the purpose for which they were granted. Section 13 is clarifying the definition of essential personnel for purposes of state special education aid. It was brought to our attention by the Special Education Directors Association that there are a number of staff who have been receiving funding, including OTs, PTs, and autism specialists who are providing the providing their service through an indirect service model as opposed to a direct service model, that those should continue to be funded, that the language change that was made in the mid-90s dealing with direct services was intended to cover administrators and supervisors, and so we've clarified that administrators and supervisors are not eligible for funding, but that other staff that are providing their services through an indirect service model, such as the OTs and PTs, would continue to be funded. Section 14 is correcting language for the omission of an effective date regarding the change in QCOMP funding that was enacted by the 2007 legislature. The intent was that the change from 73% to 65% state aid would take effect in fiscal year 10. There was no effective date in the bill. However, we did receive a letter from the committee chairs indicating that was the intent, and that's how we've been administering the program, and this would clarify that in law. Section 15 is removing language in Minnesota Statutes 127A47 that holds the non-resident district liable for tuition for not notifying the district on a timely basis. However, the department, since we have now do the calculations of tuition billing, is providing the providing the notice to the district, so that is no longer necessary. And that concludes the bill.
That's it. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know we're over time. There was one gentleman from the community ed representative from the school district that may have been in the audience for a few hours. If he's still here.
We are quite a bit over. So,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Tom Holton, the community ed director for the Bloomington and Richfield school districts, needed to leave. In deference of your time, I will be more than happy to talk with Senator Wieger and the other members of the committee privately.
Okay, great. Thank you, Senator Wieger and Commissioner and all of the members of your department. And we'll work on those areas that we know that need some additional work. So that will take place. And tomorrow we have Senator Saltzman and background checks. And then we'll also have the bullying bill that Senator Dibble has. So those two pieces of legislation. So thank you, committee members, for being so diligent. And committee is adjourned.
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, boy. Thank God.